My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Caroline. Caroline, is that
Caroline?
Right? Caroline Miller. Welcome to KBOO, and I know you live in Portland, so
I do
have to welcome you to Portland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks.
You're here to speak about two books. The title of the first book is Heartland, two words, Heartland, published by Scheel and Denver. And the second book is Gothic Spring, published by
Aslett Press.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just asked you, and I forgot about it already. Yeah. Gothic Spring is the title of that book. Let me tell the listeners a little about you. You served two terms as Multnomah County Commissioner and another as Metro Commissioner. My goodness. As a novelist, you produced Heartland, which we're going to talk about, a fictional memoir about a young boy growing up in rural Ohio in the 30s and 40s, and Gothic Spring, which we'll also talk about. That's your latest one. You have written many short stories for publications such as Children's Digest, Grit, Tales of the Talisman. One of your short stories, Under the Bridge and Beneath the Moon, was dramatized on radio here in Oregon and Washington. How'd you like the production?
I liked it. I liked it very well. Mm-hmm. And they played it for several years, you know.
How long ago was it?
Well, it was KBPS before it was actually independent.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Let's see now. It says you headed the Portland Federation of Teachers and you're enshrined in the Oregon Labor Hall of Fame. Solidarity forever.
Absolutely.
Yeah, bring down the bosses. That's what I say. Okay, well, you're in the right place.
That's why you're here, yeah, right?
That's certainly why you're here. Let's talk about Heartland first. A fictional memoir. Now, this is the story of two boys, Ollie and Herman, who grew up. Is Ockley Green the name of the town in Ohio? There's no such thing as an Ockley Green, though, right?
There's an Ockley Green in Oregon. I just like the name. It's Ockley Green School.
But this is allegedly in Ohio. You use a framing device on this thing. Why don't you talk about the framing device you use, how people get into the stories themselves?
Oh, you mean starting with the prologue?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'll just tell you, but we'll have to keep it a secret, Ed. it started as a series of short stories, and I published about four of them. And then I realized that this was a recurring character, and so I just kept writing them. Well, when I did talk to an agent, the agent said, well, short stories don't sell as well as novels. So then I had to patch it together. So I begin with an adult coming back for his mother's funeral from the Vietnam War and going through an album. So each picture then projects a story. Mm-hmm. And then in the epilogue, after having that relive, he makes a critical decision about the turn of his life.
This is Ollie, and he's a war correspondent rather than being a...
he is a war correspondent,
yeah. And
right.
His kid brother Herman, who never really liked his name, is the one who stayed back in Ohio. He much preferred to be called Lash LaRue.
That's right, Lash LaRue. I don't know that there are any readers out there old enough to remember that Cowboy Saturday series.
Yeah, he was a cowboy with a whip.
That's right.
Yeah, he was one of my heroes when I was a
kid. I loved him.
Yeah, yeah. Saturday serials, you see them on TV, and sometimes even the movie theaters would play them.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah. When I was growing up, there was one theater in the neighborhood that would occasionally, on Saturday afternoon, they would give you 20 cartoons and a serial and then a Western or something. And
yeah, they don't do that for kids anymore.
They sure don't, no.
Ed, you're too young to remember Lash LaRue, but I'm glad you do.
Okay, well, yeah, I actually saw the movies. Plus, I had this thing for bullwhips. Only after I saw Lash LaRue use a bullwhip.
Of course.
Yeah, we kids in my neighborhood would wind up hurting each other.
With made-up
bullwhips. The photos each have a little caption, and the captions are the chapter headings in the book.
Right.
I want to talk about bodacious scurvy, but only as we get into that. It occurred to me as I was reading this, there's a certain amount of longing for a world that maybe never was. I mean, I know that Ronald Reagan was self-deluded about an America that never was, but it occurs to me this kind of small town life, I don't even know if it exists anymore. It's the book is part Tom Sawyer. Some of the stories are funny. They're all warm. Some are sentimental. Tell us about that.
Well, actually, I just came from a book tour, and I hit a little town called Christmas Valley. And actually, it's not a town. It's an unincorporated den for renegades who don't want bureaucracy. And I walked into a, I think it was called the Feed Barn, and it was right out of the Maribor Diner. I mean, these are alfalfa farmers and truck drivers. And yeah, it is a longing for a time when obviously life was simpler, people communicated better. So I think it was real. I think it still exists. I fell in love with Christmas Valley, I must tell you that. And I feel it, and I still think Heartland is with us, because it's the essence of what I think is American, which is essentially, I think we're very giving people. I think we're very caring people. So I think Heartland's alive and well.
Yeah, but the people of Heartland, of Ockley Green, are not without their prejudices. There are,
oh, good for you, yes.
Yeah, there are certain, the Greek couple is a mystery to them.
Yes,
and
yes.
And they live right next door. What's her name?
Cataphias.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. right. And in fact, the two boys torture Mr. just for no other reason than he's that they think they can get away with it because he's a foreigner, right?
Yes, so, yes.
One of the ways to do it was with Bodacious Scurvy. Tell us about Bodacious Scurvy.
Well, Bodacious Scurvy is a cat that represents the American frontier spirit. You know, he's tough, he's mean, he's scarred, and he's a survivor. He takes no guff from anyone, and he defines the territory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the ways they torture the poor man next door is to put him in a sack.
Yes.
And let him loose after setting up the man with all kinds of horrible stories about creatures of the night. You know?
Yes.
Yeah. These kids, they're not mean in any stretch of the imagination, but they, like all kids, they don't ever think about the consequences
exactly.
of what they do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about Uncle Henry. I really loved Uncle Henry.
I fell in love with Uncle Henry. He just blossomed. Uncle Henry is the eccentric. Who knows, maybe even a tad autistic. He's not quite in the world, and yet he sees the world clearer than anybody else because he's able to step back from it. And people don't mind what they say in front of him. And so he has a very clear vision of what the world and people are like. So he's a very smart man, despite what people think of him.
He's the brother of the mother of the two boys.
Yes, and yes.
Tell us what Dad does.
Dad is the local town policeman, constabulary. You mentioned Ronald Reagan. You know, things are very black and white, right and wrong, good and evil. Yeah, it's very straight-laced.
Even though I was born and raised in New York City, I lived for quite a while in a small town on Long Island. And before our village police force got sucked into the county police force, we knew all the cops and all the cops mm-hmm. knew us. It was not unusual for a policeman to see us doing something wrong, and instead of running us in or hitting us on the head saying, I know your mother and I know your mother,
mm-hmm.
and
exactly.
if you ever do this again, I'm going to call them and you're going to be in big trouble. Those days are gone forever.
That would be a piece of American history that I think is lost. There is a certain anonymity, except if you get to Christmas Valley. I'm telling you, it's a cultural time warp. I love it.
The time when kids were terrified of authority figures.
Yes.
Or at least had some respect for
exactly.
them, including their parents and teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, I'm not going to say, hey, when I was a kid, it was better. It certainly was different, though.
Yes, yes. Those were times where being an adult meant something.
That's right. And any adult could discipline any child.
Exactly.
Verbally and without anybody saying, you can't say that to my son. I'm going to sue you.
Exactly. And they do in this book.
Mm-hmm. One of the sentimental stories that I liked a lot was about Craig Halverson's biscuits.
Oh.
I would like you to tell us a little bit about that story.
I'm going to tell you that it's based on a true story. I did hospice work for a number of years, and I had a client, an elder gentleman from Iowa, actually, who lived in a small town, and his mother died. He had an older brother, and he said that nobody in the house knew how to make bread, and that got me thinking, well, what does a mother do if she knows she's dying? And this is the depression period or coming out of it. They can't afford store-bought bread every day. And so here's this mother with this dilemma saying, okay, Carl, no baseball this spring. You're going to learn how to cook. And of course he resists it. He knows something's wrong with his mother, but he'd still rather be out in the baseball field. And then when she dies and he sees the chaos of the kitchen that's negative, he realizes he's disrespecting her by not treating her place as it should be. And so he makes a stab at cooking.
One of the things, my parents were depression kids. One of the things I noticed is that they really, at some point, childhood stopped, and it was pretty abrupt.
Yes.
They could be kids for a while, but after a while, they couldn't be kids anymore because they had to contribute to the family in some way, whatever it was. If cleaning up while mom went out, look for a job or getting a job themselves, childhood got put away pretty early, and that's what happens here.
Yes, yes. Carl Halvorsen has to step up and take care of his little brother and the dad who knows nothing about a kitchen except where to find it.
Yeah, that's something that's changed these days.
I'm sorry.
Well, sometimes men are better cooks than their partners are. So, there was one chapter here that just knocked me out, and even though I wasn't born when this happened, my mother, they lived in New York, and when the Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast went on the radio, and she was at a party in New Jersey.
Okay.
And they turned on the radio for some music, and they just happened to hit the Orson Welles program. And in those days, you know, there was no 24-hour news cycle. Couldn't turn on the TV and go to CNN. There was newspapers, magazines, and the radio. And you believed everything that came over the radio.
Oh, absolutely.
So tell us what happens on the War of the Worlds. I mean, for listeners who don't know what it is, Orson Welles broadcast an updated version of War of the Worlds where the Martians landed in New Jersey, and pretty soon they were taking over the world, and they did it like a documentary in a news style.
That's exactly what they did. And people really got very panicked. I understand that some people jumped out of windows. And so I use this story as a precursor to Oliver is mad at his little brother. His little brother got the best of him in the summer of the burlap bag. And Oliver has been just thinking about this. And then comes this broadcast of War of the Worlds, and that becomes the seed for Oliver's trick on his little brother. Mm-hmm. But I had to I thought Orson Welles, I'm ignorant, had written it. He hadn't. No.
H.G. Wells, another Wells.
Right. Yeah, H.G. Wells, but I mean had written the screenplay.
No.
He hadn't. And so I had to search all over because I was using it, and finally found the wife of the actual author is still alive, and I had to get her permission through her legal representative. So it was quite a chore.
Do you remember the name of the man who wrote the radio play?
I gave her credit. I had to give them credit. That was right.
I stand back. Okay.
That's all right.
Okay. One more thing about Heartland before we move on to Gothic Spring. I had so many things I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk to you about the Sonia Henie doll. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk to you about hobos, which, were a phenomenon of the Depression. But I need you to give me a minute on Hetty and the Telephone.
On what?
Hetty and the Telephone. Because this is all, you know, this is in the 1930s. Not everybody
had or
wanted a telephone.
Yeah. That's right.
Give us a little bit about Hetty and why she doesn't want a telephone.
Hetty's son, who works at the local garage, wants to get his mother a telephone so he can check on her. She's quite elderly. And she refuses to have it. And she makes the excuse that if she used the telephone, why then anybody could come over those wires and come into her room. And so she says, I'm just not going to do that, you know. Well, of course, the men are talking at the Maribor Diner, and the waitress says, you know, she says to the son, this has nothing to do with Hetty believing that people are going to come in over the wires. This has to do with her a fear that you're going to call her instead of come over, which is the heart of older people beginning to feel isolated. And so again, Ed, as you point out, it's a funny little story, but it has a grainy undertone of truth, the fear of elderly people that they aren't relevant anymore.
Because I know 30 years later, the complaint was, my kids never call me anymore.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Caroline Miller. The book we were just discussing is Heartland, which is a collection of stories about rural Ohio in the 1930s in the Depression years. We're going to move on to a book entitled Gothic Spring. Now, this is as different as chalk and cheese, these two books. This is a Gothic romance. Is that what you would call it? I mean, for want of a better terminology.
I guess that would. It's a romance, certainly. I think the film An Education, this is a young girl getting an education from an older man.
This is not an uncommon theme in Victorian novels of this type, where a headstrong young girl who's probably educated beyond her capacity to understand what she's learned falls in love with an older man because the boys around her are so crass and unattractive. But only in this case it's the vicar and he's married. Tell us a little bit about Victorine and her relationship with Jordan Fleming.
Yeah, Victorine, as you say, is very talented. She's also epileptic, so she is isolated. She doesn't go to school anymore. She's homeschooled, and then the vicar comes and gives her Bible lessons. Now, this vicar reminds her of her father, and so there's an immediate attachment that she appends to him, which he notes and takes advantage of. The third person in the triangle, of course, is Eva Fleming. And Eva's really pivotal because Eva represents the traditional Victorian woman as opposed to Victorine, who's trying to break out of this pattern and has all the talent to do it. So it's a love triangle, as usual, which is where the problems always start.
Well, it's a love triangle just between Jordan and Victorine, because Jordan is more in love with himself, I think, than Victorine is with him. So
How true,
yes. Eva's not just the Victorian wife, but she is a pastor's wife, which is, you have to be above suspicion.
Yes.
Your relationship with the congregation has to be so pure that deviating just a little bit will cause gossip, and it does.
Yes. So she represents the absolute rigidity of the culture from which she comes and is the lightning rod for all of Victorine's anger.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's somebody once said that if you snoop, whatever you see, you deserve.
That's a good one.
Yeah. In this case, the story of Nathan and Elizabeth. Tell us about the story of Nathan and Elizabeth, where Victorine finds it and what effect it has on her.
Well, this is a story that the pastor has hidden. He's a collector of old books, and he's hidden it. And she finds it. She makes a point of finding it. And it is the story of passion, which leads to ruin, that drives one to the brink of insanity. And, of course, it's a precursor to Victorine's destiny.
Of course, Victorine thinks nothing like this could ever happen to me because I'm much too smart.
Yes.
Of course, is, you know, talking about being precursor to a downfall.
The fatal flaw of all smart people.
she's a hothouse flower, Victorine is.
Yes, she is.
Completely cosseted, completely cut off, not only by being in a tiny little rural village in England in the 19th century with not much input from anything, but because her Aunt Julia hovers over her like a protective harpy and allows nothing to come into her life that Aunt Julia does not approve of, yes?
Yes, Aunt Julia comes across initially as this warm and loving person. This is, again, that underbelly. But the truth is she's never been married. She's never had a chance to have a family. And she has dug her talons into Victorine. There's a quarrel between Aunt Julia and a school teacher who wants Victorine to go to university, illness or not. And so there's that struggle. And the aunt is just not going to let go.
Mm-hmm. And it has nothing to do with her fears of Victorine's health so much as the fact that she would have lost the one thing that she has.
That's right.
There's a peculiar sense of entitlement on Victorine's part. Mm-hmm. Like all this stuff is coming to her, yes?
Yes. When you're young and beautiful and gifted, of course.
So she proceeds to do things that are probably not the smartest thing in the world for her to do, namely pursuing Jordan Fleming single-mindedly. Yeah. Jeremy, yes. A boy who has grown up with her and of course, has liked her for a long time. Tell us about Jeremy. He's kind of the honest yeoman in the story,
yes.
Here, isn't he?
Everybody, a story always needs a touchstone. All of the people in the novel have more than one motive going for them, and they're not nice people when you really look at some of them. But Jeremy is the blue-eyed, true-eyed person. He is the touchstone from which other people can be measured. He's the giver, the nurturer, the one who cares.
He's the kid you go to when you need something done.
Exactly.
Yeah. When I was reading this, I was thinking, you know, there's a classic Gothic tale, and it always involves in some way stormy nights on the moors.
Yes, of course.
Somebody going insane and and a horrific death or two, and you have all of that in here. I mean, did you decide, insanity, got that.
You know, Ed, I always wanted to write a Gothic, you know. It's all in us, you know, that storm. It was a dark and stormy night.
Yeah. So, I mean, had you read a bunch of these things?
Oh, yes. I mean, of course, Brontes. You've read the Brontes. And a little bit, I'm a great fan of Jane Austen. And while Jane doesn't have the gore of Wuthering Heights or Jane Eyre, they're all sort of dealing with women in a certain place and time trying to find themselves.
It occurred to me, having read a couple of those things, including things like The Castle of Otranto, you know, which is... I think, is that supposed to be the first Gothic novel? I don't know. But it almost took the place of science fiction in Victorian times. It's a look into a world that most of us are terrified of and have no knowledge of. Can you
exactly.
talk about that?
Exactly. A Turn of the Screw is another one.
And, of course, Frankenstein fits in there, too.
Oh, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, yeah. Which is, by the way, a great book.
It
Hollywood really,
really
ruined that one.
It's a terrific book. People should read it because it's nothing like the Boris Karloff film, which is great in and of itself, but it's just not Frankenstein.
It's not the real. Shelley gave Frankenstein a lot more heart. I think it is a peep into something that isn't foreign to us, Ed. It's there. There's a dark side to all of us. And Gothic novels gives us a safe way to kind of explore that aspect of character.
Yeah, it's the roller coaster idea. When you're in apparent danger, but no real danger, you know,
exactly.
Generally, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
You do it for a thrill.
Exactly.
You've written a bunch of short stories, and now you have these two, one a novel and one a compiled novel. What are you working on now?
I've got two novels going, and they follow... I'm more Gothic in my mentality than I am Heartland. Heartland was kind of a flaring up saying, no, we're a better country than the George Bush era. You know, we do care about other people and each other. But I have a more Gothic turn of mind because it allows me to do just what people read. That is, what is the depth of character? Of course, it's biographic. You know, what is the depth of my soul? I think any writer asks that question. And what is the depth of my evil? So I'm writing, one is finished, and it's called Trump Loy, and this explores the relationship between reality and the three ways we try to study the world: religious, mysticism, and science, and the pull of these. A girl during the French-Algerian War in a chateau that's mined with underground tunnels. So there you go.
Is it in Algeria or is it in France?
It is in the southern part of France near Marseille, where there was a lot of trucks.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is in the 40s and 50s.
It's in the 60s.
In the 60s, The trompe l'oeil, which means fool the eye.
What is truth is the question.
Now, you don't really need my advice on anything, but given your labor background, it seems to me that you could write one of those great labor novels of the early part of the 20th century, the labor struggles. It seems to me you're just the right person to do that.
Well, there you go. That is a good thought. Good Lord, there are stories, aren't there?
Well, you know, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire is something which is been forgotten except for people who know history, and now it seems to me to be a great spawning ground for a book. So there you have it.
All right, my free advice. All right, thank you. Well, you never know, Ed. I might be back here talking about it.
I certainly hope so. I hope you come back with, you said you had two books. One is Trompe l'Oeil. What's the other one?
The other is called The Necromancer, which is about reality and death.
Well, there you go.
We got both, right? Right,
yeah. What else is there?
Imagination.
That couldn't be part of reality. That's right. It's really been fun talking to you. I've been speaking with Caroline Miller. Two books. One, Heartland. Some really nice stories in here. And if you wonder what life was like in the 1930s, this will give you some idea, I think. And Gothic Spring, which is just a spooky gothic romance, and also a lot of fun to read. Caroline, I do expect you back with your other books.
Good. And Ed, in the meantime, people can follow me at carolinemillerbooks.com. Don't do Caroline Miller, because there's a far more famous writer there that they'll come to.
Okay, and I need to tell people that your name is spelled Caroline rather than L-Y.
Caroline, carolinemillerbooks.com.
Gotcha. Okay. Thanks again.
Thanks, Ed. No, it isn't.